Welcome to Let's Talk, brought to you live by the National Indigenous Radio Service, the only opportunity offered to the broader community to be informed on the issues and current affairs from a First Nations perspective. This is Chelsea Bond with Let's Talk.
I would like to acknowledge the Turrbal and Yuggera people. I would like to acknowledge the traditional owners on the land in which you're listening to us from. I'd like to acknowledge our elders, both past and present, Indigenous and non-Indigenous. We have a very special visitor today on Let's Talk, an international, I think it's my first international guest I've had on the show, Mr. John Allegon, who's a reporter from the New York Times. Welcome to the show, John.
Thank you for having me. I'm happy to be here.
Yeah, bright and early. It's a tradition on our show when we have guests, we ask them about who you are, where you come from, who's your mob, who's your people. Tell us about who's your mob.
So I kind of got the sense from whenever other Indigenous people I've met introduce themselves. Say I'm John Allegon and I'm from Trinidad. Tunapuna, it's a little town in Trinidad, and I now live in the United States. I've moved there when I was a small child, and I currently live in Kansas City, Missouri. No particular strong connections to the city other than that I live there. I'm a national correspondent for the New York Times, so usually I travel around the country and cover issues of race. So, you know, we have lots of issues dealing with race.
Whether just it be, a few, yeah.
Yeah, police shootings, education, housing segregation, you know, there's all the stuff that continues there. So I travel around the country, cover those issues, and report back on them on a national basis, yeah.
I'm going to ask, what brought your family to the U.S.?
Yeah, so, I mean, I think it was the same immigrant dream that you get just around the world, right? It's they wanted opportunity, you know, they wanted us to have a better chance of schooling because the schooling system in Trinidad, it's good, but, you know, it's a little more difficult to make your way through it. There's, you know, fewer opportunities because it's such a small island. It's like, you know, a little more than a million people. It was kind of, you know, looking for that opportunity, better jobs, better schools, and you know, just kind of opening the world to us. The same immigrant dream that I think you see across the world, really.
Yeah. And how did you get to be a journalist? When did you first think, this is what I want to do?
Yeah, so it's funny. I was back in middle school years for us. That would be, level 7 or so, that area. And I am big into sports, you know, and I just love to watch them and, you know, play them and all that stuff. So I wanted to report on sports. So that was my thing, you know, this is a cool way for me to be able to go to, you know, games and things like that. So that's actually what made me want to start doing journalism. So back, you know, in high school, I worked for the school newspaper. And in my town that I lived in, there was like an alternative news weekly, which is like a weekly newspaper that that has, you know, different arts and entertainment type stuff. So I applied and I got a job at that. You know, it was in the city that I was growing up. It was Grand Rapids, Michigan at the time.
Right.
So I did some work there. I did a high school program, the Detroit Free Press in Detroit, Michigan. They had this high school program. So I got to spend like 6 weeks there over the summer writing articles and whatnot.
Yeah.
You know, totally loved it, you know. And then I went on to college in near Chicago. It's called Northwestern University. It's in Evanston, Illinois. Yeah. Studied journalism there and, you know, did internships every summer. You know, I spent a year in Germany in college. Did an internship at the former communist newspaper there. Neues Deutschland was called New Germany. So I did an internship there. So I've just stuck with it throughout. And so when I started off in my professional career, I was covering sports. First for the Detroit Free Press. And then a year into my career, I got a job at the New York Times. And I started off covering sports. It's great. You know, I got to go to the Winter Olympics in Italy.
Wow.
Got to cover boxing in Las Vegas. Got to cover NBA basketball, you know, so it was great, you know. And then
I want to be a sports reporter. Jeez.
Yeah, it's a lot of fun, you know. It's but the thing about it too, I have varied interests too, and that was the thing about sports journalism for me. It was fun, but it kind of gets monotonous and routine, it seems like. It's the same season every year and every 4 years in Olympics, and it just seems like, but so I wanted to do other issues of news and whatnot. So 2 years into my New York Times career, I switched over to news side. So I started covering New York City stuff.
Okay.
Then I covered court cases in New York City, which is, you know, fraught with its own racial strife and problems and whatnot. Lots of social problems there. But it was fascinating. You know, I was at the courthouse every day. I did a quick stint covering state government in New York. You know, so we have different state governments as you do here.
Yeah.
And then just did that, 6 months, and then they wanted a national correspondent out in Kansas City, and I put my hand up for that because my wife is from a city, St. Louis is, it's where the big Ferguson, close to where of the big course, Ferguson uprising yeah. happened. It's about 4 hours drive from where we live, so that's how I kind of, that's the journey of how I got to where I am now.
For our listeners who may not be aware, when you referred to the Ferguson uprising, yeah. can you explain to us, for the listeners who don't know?
Yeah, so in Ferguson, Missouri, it's a small suburb outside of St. Louis, and 2014, August 9th, I believe, 2014, a young man, Michael Brown, 18-year-old black man, he was coming home from a store with a friend, had a run-in with a police officer. They exchanged words. There was some physical struggle between them. Ended up with him being shot and killed by the police officer. And that was really, I would say, the genesis of the modern Black Lives Matter movement, which is, more so, I guess, our new era of civil rights. The United States had its civil rights struggle through the 60s. There's been various struggling since then, but I think what we're seeing is a new kind of civil rights struggle, as I like to call it.
I mean, from Australia, it's like every week there's a new,
exactly. And that brought new scrutiny on how police treat communities of color in the U.S., lots of scrutiny about, policies and just broader issues as to why. Because the thing that people found in Ferguson is that you have all these things repeating themselves, where you have a predominantly black city where almost all the elected officials were white. You have most of the black people in that city living in poorer conditions, all kind of stuffed in one place. You still have this housing segregation. You still have, all these issues. And I think Ferguson represented a lot of that. So that's one reason that it was a spark. Because, sadly, lots of people have gotten shot and killed by the police in the United States before Michael Brown did. Not all of them will get that attention, but I think there were just so many factors there that related. I think part of it was his family was a family that was very much about going to try and get justice. So Michael Brown, that was what happened to Ferguson. And the police officer, he was never criminally charged. They cleared him. I think there's a civil suit going on right now. But it did really lead to some true reforms and a closer scrutiny across the country, because since then you've had many other cases across the country that have gotten close attention and there were some really also some very I want to say fiery protests. A lot of people say violent protests. I don't like it because it was mostly they were smashing like windows and property and stuff like that. I see violence against a person. I don't see violence against a building. It was kind of that emotion coming out in folks.
Grief.
It's grief, trauma. It's kind of all kind of accumulates, that's what it was. It was this pressure cooker that had been building for many years, and then throughout that area and that part of St. Louis, they'd been, I think it's a similar thing to what you all have here, where the Dew case in Western Australia, where she was died in prison, that was a case where she was picked up for and put in prison in jail because she couldn't pay her fines, right? And it's exact connection in Ferguson. That's another thing that came out, is that there were these debtors' prisons, so people were getting pulled over by the cops, they were getting fined, they weren't paying them, they weren't showing up to court, so it increases fines and it just builds and builds, and then you get these cases where people are arrested there and they're thrown in jail for not being able to pay.
The criminalization of poverty.
Exactly. Yeah. It's the same thing that you all have happening here, that I think, that was exposed in a new way in the U.S. and people hadn't looked at it.
I mean, I was one of my questions, this isn't the murdering of black people by the state is not new.
Yeah.
And I'm wondering, to what extent do you think the smartphone and the filming of this has helped bring attention to or validated what black people have said the state has been doing? I mean, we've seen here in Australia the footage of a number of murders of black people, and I just wonder whether you think that's had an influence in terms of bringing to public consciousness. We actually get to see.
I mean, it's definitely changed the game, I think. I would start with saying, there's these new activists who have, were born out of these conflicts. There's a guy, Duray McKesson, who was just worked in education in the state of Minnesota in the U.S. He came down to Ferguson.
I think I've seen him on Twitter.
Duray, D-E-R-A-Y.
Yeah, that's right, yeah.
Yeah, and Yeah, I mean, he just came down. He was just a regular person. And he came down and started tweeting and posting pictures of the protests every night, the tear gas, you know, because the police confronted the protesters with tear gas. And there was just a lot of, you know, tense emotions, high emotions there. And, yeah, he this is a guy who, you know, no one knew. He probably had, like, 100 Twitter followers. And now he's got, like, you know, 400,000 or something like that. It's, you know, and that's kind of a symbol, I mean, of what the power of social media. Like, the reason he got so many followers is because he was chronicling and because he got so many followers from chronicling, and obviously more eyes and more people are watching it, right?
Is it that people need to see the violence firsthand to actually validate it and get it? I think about, like, in the time of Martin Luther King, and when, you know, the world saw what was being done to the protesters, the you know, the hoses, the dogs being set upon people, which horrified members of, you know, and we're seeing this footage today, what's happening to black bodies, and we're seeing the violence that people have to see it in order to actually accept that it's really happening.
Yeah, I think it's a bit of a Rorschach test in the sense that I think folks who have known it's been going on for a while, you know, obviously they don't have to see it. It's like, I think to a certain degree, yeah, it does validate it, what's been going on. But I think at the same time, you will have instances happening where the video, if you are a person who is of the opinion that, you know, these folks, these black people who are getting killed are criminal and they did something to contribute to their own death, then it's really not going to make a difference. Like, for instance, so another case we had was Walter Scott, the man in North Charleston, South Carolina. And he was running from the cop. And there's video of him back, clear as day video. And his first trial ended in a mistrial. Like, because there was one juror that was a holdout. And they couldn't, if you can't convict, you know, he's going to be retried, but if you can't on the first time convict a man who shoots at a black man, who is literally running away from him, no weapons in his hand, he's literally running away from him, and he literally shoots him in the back, and you see it clear as day on video, it seems like video could only validate it so much. But I think one thing that video has done, though, as well, this is a real critique of my industry, the media, is it brings more media attention to it, because when we see videos, I think two things. When you see videos and you see stuff online, that riles up. It doesn't just validate it, but I think it riles up the people who are already, like, you know, sick of this. You know, they actually get to see the stuff in the street. They're like, oh, they're doing that there. Let me go out there, you know. And then I think that riling up and that creating those images of the street of tear gas and firebombs and things like that, that will get the media's attention. Because in Ferguson, there was a gas station convenience store that was burned down like a night or two after Mike Brown got killed. And I contend that for Ferguson to have gotten the attention it did, that gas station had to burn down, because the fact is, I don't think a lot of media would have gone if there wasn't this image of it burning down. I think there was a local photographer for the local newspaper who got, like, some of the protesters, like, or the people who were looting and stuff in the store, they'd come in, like, they'd, like, pummeled him a little bit because they were upset that he was taking their picture right there.
Yeah.
So, I mean, there was that story got out there. So I think that's what really, like, when the media saw those images, oh, my goodness, people, you know, going crazy in the streets. That, sadly, was more shocking than a black man getting killed in the head, you know. So, I think the media is been slow to act in the past, and I think that, you know, social media kind of speeds up that reaction a little, because when things, you know, go crazy online and stuff, then, you know, we can't ignore it in a way. And in some way, you know, whatever the route you get there to getting more attention, whether it has to be, you know, sadly through, you know, something burning down or something like that, it's the more attention that you're finally getting. And I do think, you know, there has been a lot of good journalism around the actual issues, you know, once they got there, you know.
Yeah.
I still think there's a lot of glorification, you know, and this is, you know, my publication, I might be guilty of it as well, like, in terms of glorification of some of the, you know, the protests and what goes on there. But I think, you know, a lot of the exposure of the debtors' prisons and different things, you know, problems with the school segregation, housing segregation, that reporting that has continued, I think that's been a good result of it.
I mean, I agree with you. I think of the tragic death of Morinji on Palm Island, and I don't think we would have known about it unless those mob had rioted in that place and, you know, did what they did. We wouldn't have. It would just be another death in custody that
That's why I always kind of chuckle when people say, you know, I'm okay with protests as long as it's peaceful. If it were peaceful protests, you would never know about it. You wouldn't pay attention. Like, it was funny. I was reading an article about, and someone was talking about, he said he was talking to a white person. The person was talking about, you know, as long as they're peaceful and whatnot. And he goes, oh, you mean kind of like Colin Kaepernick? And I don't know if you heard Colin Kaepernick. He's an American football player. He knelt during the national anthem. When he first started sitting, then he knelt, you know, to be a little more respectful. During the national anthem in America. In America, it's a big thing when the national – I don't know if it's like that here. When the national anthem is playing, you stand up and you – America's this,
like – your hand on your heart?
Yeah, hand on the heart. You know, sing along if you can. Yeah. You know, like America's like overzealous with patriotism, you know.
It's creeping, you know, in here, but not this. It's not the.
Yeah,
the
I probably shouldn't say this because they might not let me back into the country. But I do have a U.S. passport, so I should be okay.
Fingers crossed. We'll be thinking of you, eventually. Yes.
But yeah, I think there's a zealous patriotism in America, and people were so offended. Like, you're disrespecting veterans, military veterans, by doing that. There was all this, you know, talk about it, and that's the thing. You know, no matter what protest you do, people are going to find a way to. If they don't agree with what you're protesting, they're going to find a way to not like it, right? So it was funny. This guy said he was having this conversation with this white guy, and he said they were talking about, you know, as long as protests are peaceful. He goes, oh, like Colin Kaepernick, you mean? And the guy was like, well, no, you know, because he didn't agree with the Colin Kaepernick protests either. So this idea of peaceful protests versus, you know, versus violent resistance. Yeah. I think people forget that, you know. One, Martin Luther King's reputation is sanitized a little bit. I mean, he was willing to do what it takes, I think. And the guy I always look up to is Nelson Mandela. And, you know, I'm not good with quotes, but he basically said words to the effect that, like, nonviolent protest is no good without the threat of violence, without the possibility that, hey, if this doesn't work, then we will go to other means. That's why he was training with the Umkhonto Wesizwe, with the guerrilla forces that the party started at the time. They were all training up and getting ready, you know. They were ready to do things that they needed to do.
But even the discourse of nonviolent protest, it was inherently violent.
Yeah.
To black bodies.
Yeah, exactly.
The need to see that violence is something. The case of Miss Stu and the footage in her cell of when they dragged her out, and her family had to protest to get that footage shown, and because they didn't want to make it public, and the family wanted people to see what happened to her body, what happened to her, in order to believe what happened. And, you know, it's this kind of conflict we have of that we have to put our bodies on the line and show the damage that is done to those bodies in order to get attention, to get, you know, people to care. But if people don't see you as human, then it's that footage doesn't matter anymore, you know. It's
But I think it's powerful. I mean, you talk about in the U.S. we had this thing, the Emmett Till killing. This was back earlier in the 1900s, a young boy from he was in Mississippi. I think he was from Chicago, but he was in Mississippi visiting family, and he supposedly whistled at a white woman and was flirting with her. And the white woman's husband and his friends, they killed him. They lynched him, and he was so horribly mutilated. His mother said, "I want an open casket." She wanted. I think it appeared on the cover of a magazine in the U.S. She wanted people to see, and it's a hard image to look at, but like. If you want to see, you know, that violence that you talk about, that trauma, I mean, that really grabs people. And I guess I do think to some extent that, you know, seeing it does change it. Like seeing what was done to Ms. Du in Western Australia, it changes the discourse, I think.
Yeah. Okay. Now you've come to Australia.
I have.
And what can you tell us about what brought you here?
Yeah. So, you know, covering race in the U.S., you know, we obviously have lots of issues and whatnot there. But I wanted to, you know, take a look at what's going on in Australia, because I think, you know, this year is especially some really monumental stuff. You know, it's been 25 years since the Mabo decision and 50 years since 67, that referendum. So it was kind of wanted to, you know, take stock of or explore how has racial dynamics changed? How is it the same? Kind of what's going on with racial dynamics in Australia, and kind of see, you know, where the compares and contrasts to what I'm seeing in the U.S. and just kind of where Australia is going on a racial front, because I think it's an extremely important issue here. From what I've gathered from people I've spoken with, it also seems like it's a more difficult thing to talk about in a way, because especially, you know, I'd probably say the Aboriginal Torres Strait Islander population is the one that has suffered the most, you know, under a lot of these racial strife and whatnot. It's a very small population compared to, you know, the communities of color in the U.S. So
because we're like 3%.
Yeah, 3%.
And what is it over there?
Like the black population is about 12%, and the Latino population is even more than that. Mm. And I think that, you know, because it's so small, it might be harder to get your voices heard, and the problems that you all experience might be seen as more isolated.
Mm.
So I think that that's... I really wanted to engage in how it's viewed here and how racial issues are viewed here.
I mean, it's even interesting, your sort of bio title of race correspondent, race writer.
Yeah.
I don't think we'd have anything, any journalist that would necessarily have that or for a, you know, mainstream news media, because we just don't like to talk about race at all in this country.
Yeah.
And are you familiar with Adam Goods?
Yeah, it was a football player, right, who did a dance or
he
something?
He danced, which was seen, like much like Colin Kaepernick, you know, that he celebrated after scoring a goal and danced. I mean, prior to that, he had a spectator ejected for recalling him an ape on when he was and that was seen as aggressive, and he was the perpetrator and all of this. And he was, you know, harassed throughout his final years of his playing career. It's interesting that he spoke about race and racism, and that was another reason that people were really angry at him, because he won Australian of the Year, and he used that to talk about Australia's history and the disadvantage that Indigenous people experience, and people were angry at him for speaking about it, not angry at the injustice, but him speaking about it. And so we have a whole lot of hysteria when we actually say the R word. And I've actually heard people refer to it as the R word, as though it's like the N word. But, you know, it's so we have a lot of anxiety even to talk about race and racism in this country.
I feel like it's the same as what I see in the US. There's a lot of anxiety. It's always, oh, why do you always make this about race? And, you know. But the fact is, some people have to live it every day, you know? You have to, you know, we have to live in our skin every day. I'm a radio, your listeners can't see me. I'm a black man from the island of Trinidad, as I said, with dreadlocks. So, I mean, overall, my experience, because thankfully I've had some privilege in my life, you know, my parents have, you know, had good jobs, I've been able to get myself a good job, you know, that's afforded me certain things, obviously. It doesn't allow me to escape racism.
Yeah, class doesn't remedy racism. Yeah. Racism is means tested.
Exactly. People, when I hail a cab, they don't. My salary isn't above my head, or
your occupation on your forehead.
Yeah, exactly. It's just who I am, you know. So, but you know, I've been, you know, honored to like kind of have some of these privileges. So a lot of the so maybe in some ways I don't bear the brunt of a lot of it, but like the fact is, you know, I still have to live it. And the fact is, there are people. Of color in the U.S. and here, I imagine as well, who do have to live it and bear the brunt of it every single day, and that's, you know,
and can't rely on the legitimacy of one's occupation and class to be able to negotiate some of those encounters.
Absolutely, yeah.
Like, but I'm a good one. I'm safe, you know. Yeah. But it shouldn't matter if I'm.
I would see this when I covered courts. You know, I had one story where the courthouse. So I go check in on some trials and stuff like that, and you can walk in the courtroom and there's like a rail up there, and they have the court case. So I was going up there to check the docket. You know, anyone can just walk up there, and there's court going on, but you can do it. Just be quiet and whatnot. And excuse me. And I got up there, and I was looking at for the case, and one of the court officers just told me, "Oh, just go sit down and wait for your attorney." You know, thinking I was a defendant. You know, there, and it's just stuff like that would, you know,
know your place.
Yeah, little things like that would happen. You know, and I mean, can I blame him for thinking that when a quarter of the world's population, incarcerated population, is in the United States, and most of those people are black, you know, make up 12% of the population. I don't know the percentage of the prison population, but it's well more than 12%. You know, it's definitely more. So in some ways, we've created a society where that's the only thing he could have thought, right? I mean, what else was he supposed to think about me? I mean, we incarcerated all these people, all these black people, and I'm a black man in a courtroom. Where did he see me as, you know?
Yeah.
So...
I still remember, my husband Matthew and his mistaken identity in various contexts. So we went on one of those cruise ships around the South Pacific, and a lot of the workforce on those cruise ships are people from the South Sea Islands and stuff. And Matthew went to take the kids down to a kids' club on the ship, and he was wearing a red shirt, polo shirt, and a lot of the staff wear red polo shirts. And he returned from dropping the kids off and came back and said, "This white family tried to give me their children." And he said, "I think maybe it was the colour of my shirt."
Yeah.
And I said, "Yes, Matthew, of course it's the colour of your shirt that they've..." And at the same time, you know, being street checkpoint police, walking the kids to school, this kind of, we need to surveil black bodies because we know where they're located. Mm-hmm. You know, it makes sense to presume that you're there, for court.
Exactly.
Not to report on
exactly,
it.
That's the little struggle we live in. You know, I was talking with Stan Grant when I was in Sydney, and some of these things might not be life changing, but you know, for me, because like I said, I've had the privilege to have parents who instilled the confidence in me to, you know, say screw that and I'm going forward.
But
what does that do to people who haven't had that education I have, who haven't had that, you know, socialization that I have to be able to withstand those bullets, you know, those it's death by a thousand cuts, you know, how they might be getting those little cuts, but even deeper cuts than that, you know, they might be, what does that do to their psyche? You know, that's even, you know, I try with my reporting to always get in someone, in other people's shoes and like really, you know.
I love that you're talking about privilege a lot. And we try, you know, try to talk about privilege and, you know, there's the term white privilege there's often an uncomfortability when we try and get people to recognise their own privilege. And it's like, no, we own our privilege. And I know that class does not protect me from racism, but it may help me manage and navigate it in certain ways. And so if I have an encounter that is violent, I have the means to go, well, I'm going to go away for the weekend. I'm going to go to a movie and escape from that reality for a moment to recover. So having, you know, the means to be able to manage it, the privilege of being able to use a doctor title and an official work identity in complaining about something because I can get hurt. I can, I'm really glad that you're talking about privilege because we have people who feel really uncomfortable talking about privilege as though somehow they feel like they're being attacked. And we all have to recognize that privilege.
And the way I can, you know, look at my being a male, you know, because I think it was actually a white...
Yeah, that's a thing too.
Exactly. it's actually a white guy and I think he was a professor at the University of Missouri who he told me this story once, like, because he's doing some work around, you know, helping, you know, around understanding privilege and that type of stuff. And he said one thing that he says to some of his, like, white students is, white males, is to imagine, I think it's like, imagine yourself like you're a woman walking through a big frat party. We have these big fraternities, these male clubs. Imagine being a woman walking through there, how that's different than me, you know. And because you, as a male, you may not be able to understand a lot of things, but I know what it would be like to be a woman walking through like a party with a bunch of guys versus being a man walking. You just, no one looks at you, you're just another guy, right? But being a woman, you're objectified and looked at in so many different ways. And that's something that, that's totally true. And that really helped me, you know, I saw that connection. You know, I mean, I knew it before, but, you know, that's a really good example in a way of thinking about it, I think.
Yeah.
Because as a male, I mean, you know, my wife is a black woman, you know, I can't imagine what she has to go through. And I can't imagine because she tells me stories of people going through it. We live in Kansas City. The city itself is about, you know, 25 to 28% black, but and then the decent percentage of Latino, but she works out in Kansas, so like in a suburb where it's pretty much all of her coworkers are white, you know, and whatnot, and so she has some, you know, interesting things she has to navigate there. And hey, can I go back just one quick thing about, you know, what brought me here too? I just wanted to make sure to say, you know, so we're interested in looking at, you know, how what's happened since the Mabo decision and the 67 and what the state is. And I wanted to, I have to make sure to mention that we're actually partnering with the ABC here. And you know, I'm traveling around. I've been traveling around the country with them to do we're doing a foreign correspondent documentary. So, you know, they usually send people abroad to do foreign correspondent documentaries. So this is the first time they're doing one in Australia, and I'm honored to be the reporter on that, you know. So,
and it's fitting that you're meeting Indigenous Australia.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So it's we've been at it for, you know, almost 3 weeks now. It's a 3-week shoot, and then we got a lot of post production stuff to do to get it ready for the air. But I think in May it should be airing, and it'll be. So I've traveled to, you know, Kununurra on the west, western Australia. I've traveled to the Torres Strait Islands. I'm in here in Brisbane now, in Inala, and back to Sydney. And so we're reporting on, you know, because we really wanted to get a full scope and breadth of the Aboriginal experience, the Torres Strait Islander experience. It's something I've learned along the way. I can't leave out the great Torres Strait Islanders, which were interesting. I felt a kinship with them because they're islanders, and they reminded me a lot. When I looked at them, they looked a lot more like me, I felt, and they reminded me of it reminded me a little bit of being in Trinidad, you know.
So
it's a co-production with the ABC we're doing. So I'm going to be doing this documentary as well as writing something that'll appear on both the New York Times and ABC website. So it's so I'm really glad that ABC's given me this platform to, you know, and this airtime, you know, to really
so are we, because we don't get in, you know, there are limited options in terms of having our stories told. So it's really exciting to see, and actually I think important for someone to come from overseas to come and have a look at this space.
Yeah, it totally makes sense because I can think in the U.S., you know, one of the benefits of the New York Times is we often switch people around in our beats a lot because we want fresh eyes on those beats. So, you know, it's something that could always be done, you know, because if you come in with more of a novice understanding or come in a little bit, you know.
And there's a genuine curiosity.
Yeah,
Tell me about this.
I mean, I might be asking stupid questions, but at least, you know, sometimes you realize that those stupid questions, people who know about it don't even necessarily ask those questions, and you can discover more.
You make presumptions about,
And what a lot of Australians have told me when I told them my trip, they're like, oh, I've never even been to those places. You know, like to get to Murray, we went to Murray Island, and to get there, I mean, we had to charter a plane from Horn Island there, which is not cheap, you know. So I imagine most people have. I mean, I know most people have not been to Murray Island.
Absolutely, I haven't been there.
Clearly, I mean, it's overwhelmed, but it's fascinating to see it all.
Can we go through some of the stops you've had? Can you take us to your first stop and tell us about those communities, who you've met, and what you found? So you know, and I know you're in the middle of this journey, so it's sometimes it's hard to reflect on it.
Yeah, I've been writing down thoughts and stuff, you know. But yeah, I mean, my first stop was literally Sydney. I mean, I landed in Sydney, spent a couple days there, and did a couple interviews there. It was interesting because I spoke with Nakia Louie and Jeffrey Winters. He had run for a seat down there, and he's a lawyer.
Yeah.
And to hear them talk about this perspective of being not only young, kind of successful Aboriginal people, but also very fair-skinned, and what, you know, what that does to you in terms of, oh, you're not Aboriginal, are you really, you know, and she's Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander, so she's a mix. It was kind of interesting to see, you know, which is very much I guess in some ways a similar challenge to what, you know, I see in my sphere and in my sphere of friends back in the U.S., which is, you know, tend to be professional working Black people. And yeah, it's kind of a similar question. Is like what legitimizes you? Like you have to legitimize yourself as being that.
And it's funny the identity talk around the part and, you know, not quite, not full. And you look at the history of this country and the way in which Aboriginality has been constructed, because it is a racial classification, a construction of the colonized. We've never known ourselves as Aborigines. Mm-hmm. That is a label that has been given to us. And from, you know, we went from being not human to a dying, vanishing race, to being now we're not really Aboriginal. And even in contemporary talk, it's not really disadvantaged enough because we imagine that Aboriginality equals disadvantage.
Yeah,
and so they kind of share this common theme of insisting that we aren't really here.
Yeah, yeah.
Which, you know, serves the colonial project.
Yeah, yeah. And I mean, it takes me back, you know, to what the president, the current president of the U.S., Donald Trump, has said when he does his outreach to Black people. I remember during the campaign, he was asked a question in one of the debates about what is he going to do about, you know, race issues or something like that. And he talked about one bringing more police in the communities, which is,
let's surveil those bodies more.
Yeah, that's, to be fair, there is, like, a part of the population, I guess, especially kind of some of the older black population who, you know, really wants the police and welcomes them.
Oh, because, absolutely.
Because really, there is, you know, there's violence.
We're victims of crime, too.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, it's about how they police. I think a lot of people that I talk to in the U.S. about it, black people, it's not, they try to stress this thing, I'm not anti-police, for better policing. Which it can be a hard line to straddle, right?
You know, well, it's that thing, and the frustration we have here is that we are surveilled regularly by police as potential perpetrators. But when we seek assistance from police as victims of crime, we are dismissed. Yeah. So if there was an equal commitment to concern for us as victims of crimes, as well as perpetrators of crimes, then we'd kind of go, yeah, fair.
Yeah.
But it's that mismatch.
Yeah, there's been instances in the U.S. where black person has called the cops for help and ended up getting shot. I did a story about that. There was one guy, he was actually a security guard at a apartment complex or something, and he was armed, he was a security guard, and he called the cops because he saw something suspicious. The cops came out and they ended up shooting and killing him because he had his gun in his hand, and it was kind of freaky, you know. But yeah, I forgot what was I talking about. I think I was going somewhere with this.
We were talking about, you went to Sydney, and we were talking about identity
Yeah, so, I mean, it's, like I was saying, it's interesting to kind of, you know, see where they have the similar identity struggle as us with who we are.
Now, where'd you go after Sydney?
So after Sydney, we went out west to Kununurra.
In WA, Western Australia?
Yes, Western Australia, yeah. So that was interesting because, I mean,
which part of is in Western Australia? Is it up, south, north?
I think it's like north. Mm-hmm. I think it's north of Perth, so a couple hours north of Perth. Flying was like, you know, a good 2.5 hours north of Perth, so probably, you know, like 10 hours driving or something like that.
Yep.
It's a very big country, as I'm learning.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so...
And what brought you there? How did you...
So, the kind of the idea that we, you know, in kind of talking with the ABC folks about how we wanted to do this, we said, let's kind of get a good range of the issues. So... We said, let's do Sydney. That'll give us, you know, kind of perspective of kind of the real cosmopolitan type, you know.
And Sydney's home to our largest Indigenous population.
Yeah, exactly. Because it's the largest population. Yeah. And that's the thing, you know, like most Indigenous people don't live on a remote community somewhere. They live in a city, right? You know, that's another thing that kind of goes over people's heads. So Kununurra, we wanted to really get this feel of like, you know, the kind of the remote kind of community type feel and what that means, and there's also a mine there, and kind of so we kind of talk a little bit about how mining and resource royalties, how they are benefiting or not benefiting the community. That was kind of, you know, one of the reasons that we chose to go out there.
And how long did you spend out there? And
what
did you learn about that place?
Yeah, so we were out there for about 3 or 4 days. It was interesting because it's one of those places where you'll see a lot of, you know, young Aboriginal people just kind of hanging out on the streets. You know, there's like, you know, doesn't seem to be too vibrant per se, you know, which was interesting to me. And I went out with a guy who, this guy named Ted Hall, who he kind of does some work with the mine. He worked for the mine for a couple of years. It's in Argyle Diamonds Mine. It's like the largest producer of pink diamonds in the world there. And it was interesting. His conflict, you know, this tug and pull of, like, on the one hand, getting some benefit from the mine being there, but on the other hand, feeling like it's not enough. To me, it was kind of symbolic of what I've been hearing. It's like, yes, there have been concessions. There have been apologies. There have been, you know, laws. There have been some of it has done some really meaningful things.
Yep.
But there's all this sense of not enough. Like, Ted, he's squatting on property owned by the mine because he wants to... He asked them if he could have that part, you know, before under the agreements that when the mine closes, then it goes, the title goes back to the traditional owners, right?
Yeah.
And he wants to, before that, kind of get this deal going where he could have a plot there and he could run a tourism business out there, and a couple other things. And they wouldn't let him, like, they wouldn't allow him, so he just took a trailer and parked it on there, and he's parked there, and they asked him, can you move? He's like, no, and it was just interesting to me, you know, that's that resistance, right, and that's that sense of that there's not enough been done, and that's a really, I think, was a strong sense of what I'm feeling.
There are concessions, but the status quo remains. So long as it doesn't disrupt.
It's not really the dramatic radical concessions that I think a lot of Aboriginal people might want. You know, and I also wonder if there's a generational divide.
Mm.
I kind of just thought about that now, but I mean, I didn't explore that as much yet. But like I was telling you, there's some elderly people who are okay with having more police in the neighborhoods and whatnot, where the young people might be, you know, the ones who are more closely affected by police presence.
Yeah.
I also wonder, because, you know, they talk about a lot of the traditional elders and whatnot who the mine will often deal with. Their interests might be different than what some of the younger generation might want with it, you know. And that was one of the sad things to see in Kununurra. Like, there's, you know, so many youth there. It just seems like, you know, I didn't see what they could see beyond those borders. You know, I did talk to some who, you know, definitely wanted to get out of there, you know, and it's that question, you know, do we want them all to leave those towns, or do we want them to, you know, stay there? But
if uncle can't even get his business up on his land, you know,
why would they stay? You know, and naturally, when you have a smaller place, obviously there's not going to be as many business opportunities as there are in Brisbane or, you know, Sydney or something like that. But it's like, what is the opportunity there for them? And that's, I think, a big question.
That demands sort of more significant structural change. Insisting that kids go to school and comply. And then your next stop after that, where did you go from there?
So we went up to the Torres Strait Islands. So we spent the night on Thursday Island, spent the day there, went fishing.
Did you catch anything?
The first time they threw the line, they hooked a shark. We were there, and he's like, and we were live on Facebook when we were doing that. And he's like, I think it's a shark. He's like, I'm like, oh yeah, whatever. And then all of a sudden, the shark is like swimming next to the boat, and he has the shark on the line. He caught a queenfish, I think it was called. Okay. It's pretty big, a nice size.
I'm not a fisherman.
That's another thing. I think we were talking about this the other day. How in those. Both in Kununurra and Torres Strait Islands, how people out there, they know every insect, bird, tree, and whatnot. That was just amazing to me. And yet, you know, and it's one thing I saw, like all the tourism businesses are being run by, you know, white people or the hotels and stuff like that. And I'm like, man, with that knowledge of your land, I mean, it's your, I mean, they grew up with this knowledge, you know, this is something.
There is a thing in this country about the failure to recognize Indigenous knowledges, whether it's in community or in the academy. And that contest of going, well, you would think that this industry would seek to.
They should be the ones owning the industry, right? I mean, That kind of. I don't want to say it surprised me. People always ask me what surprised me. Nothing surprises me, honestly. But that's one thing I found very interesting. Like, you know, the receptionist at the hotel and, you know, in Thursday Island when we arrived there, and then in on Horn Island as well. Like, one of them was from Britain, the other one was from Argentina or something like that. Why are people from Britain and Argentina working at these places?
And because often the market... you know, international visitors want to come and encounter Indigenous Australians. And I teach Indigenous studies at university, and our courses are more than half of some of our subjects are international students who are here for a semester, particularly most from the US.
Yeah.
And they're like, well, we're here. We want to actually learn about Indigenous Australia while we're in Australia.
Yeah.
And so we see that even in that space, that there's this certainly an interest to want to get to know us.
And that's the thing, like, what do you want to learn? I mean, if you just see Indigenous cultures like being out in the bush, that's one thing, but Indigenous cultures hanging in Inala, right? I mean, it's going...
4077.
Which I'm excited. I guess I'm going to be hanging out with the Indigenous Intruders this weekend. Mm-hmm. I think they have a... I don't know when this is airing. Maybe this will air after their concert, but they have a concert, and I'm excited to go see that, you know, and that's Indigenous culture too, right? I mean, it's everything.
Absolutely. And so, yeah, you've come to Inala.
Yeah.
Look, but before we go to come to Inala, so what was this kind of angle with the Torres Straits and going there? What were you interested in?
It was kind of, you know, because they obviously have this treaty with Papua New Guinea, which also includes the thing about respecting the customary fishing rights, because fishing is not only it's what they do to survive, you know, to eat food, but it's also something that they do to make money too, you know, as selfish and whatnot. So it was about seeing... when there is a treaty in place, when there are, you know, on paper, these customary rights, what difference does that have, you know, than the, like, mainland Aboriginal Australians who don't have I believe I'm correct, like, don't have a treaty respecting or
we are the only Commonwealth nation that does not have a treaty with its indigenous peoples.
Yeah. Yeah, so...
Australia.
Yeah, that seems like a whole other conversation, right? That's that's obviously a loaded conversation here. And loaded even within the community, right? It doesn't seem there's 100% agreements on what to do.
Well, the thing is, because we're not... pardon the pun, we're not one nation. Yeah. Australia is made up of many Aboriginal nations, and so and you see a lot of mob that are doing nation building work, but work within their own country with their own mob, and so there's not this this, you know, we don't have this one position as an Indigenous standpoint about this issue, but we have many different nations who the state needs to reconcile with, again, pardon the pun, but negotiate with, and we've yet to see the commitment to negotiating with nations here, and that's our unfinished business as a nation, I think. It's going to be a long journey.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely, yeah. And so, yeah, it was kind of to go to Torres Island and explore what that is, and we went to Murray Island, you know, Eddie Mabo's home. Spent some time there, saw his grave, and, it was interesting because, you know, I got a sense that, on the one hand, it was interesting, one, to go to a space in Australia where black people were the majority, right? Not just the majority, but the overwhelming majority. So it was like you go there and you suddenly see, like, you see, it was just a very visual difference than Kununurra, where part of it is, I think, you're on an island, so things are just relaxed. You're on an island. I mean, it's an island, right?
It is a beautiful place.
It's a beautiful place. Very beautiful place. I thoroughly loved it there. Besides the mosquitoes, but so it's like this beautiful place. You see a bunch of I felt like immediately I saw less kind of hanging around and standing around than I saw in Kununurra, and most people were either like coming from work or on lunch break, or, you know, most of the black folks I saw, and it was about looking at that beauty and that, you know, success, but also seeing that what lies beneath that is still the same frustration I saw the other guy had, where you've given us something but it's not enough, right? It's I believe they were saying the prawn fishing industry, which is the most lucrative one, that is 0% indigenous owned there. They own other fisheries there. They are 100% in, like, fin. I think they have 100% of finfish, but the most lucrative one they own 0%. The second most lucrative, I think, is rock lobster. They own 50% of that one. You know, so it's that issue of, you know, the unfulfilled, you know, the unfulfilled dream still there, you know, it's still not completely whole there for a lot of people there, despite what the beauty might suggest.
And then, so your last stop this week has been Inala. What brought you to Inala?
Well, you did, of course, right?
I wasn't trying to lead you there, but
Well, you know,
why go to an urban space?
Yeah, well, one, it's to get more of that sense of, like, what it, you know, means to be indigenous in 2017. That's not just living in the bush, or, you know, and it's also to kind of see, you know, as how do you navigate that as a professional person, as a professional family, in the case of you and Matthew, you know, you all have chosen to stay in a community which some people who may have given it a bad rap, you know, people who've probably never been there and never spent any meaningful
time there.
Yeah, it's
most of us don't live there that think it's a terrible place.
Yeah, that's a big thing that happens in the U.S. I wrote a story last year about how if you compare black families who earn a high living to white families who earn a high living in the U.S., the black families disproportionately live in poorer neighborhoods than the white families. And I met with some families, and part of that is, you know, the history of wealth, how wealth was generated, and black families weren't able to accumulate wealth. Another part of it is, some of it is choice, like they want to live in communities where they feel comfortable. And that's another thing I wanted to explore is, like, you know, how does that calculation go for, you know, a family of means that could potentially live, you know, in many other communities, but they've chosen to stay there, and kind of what I want to see the community through their eyes, and really kind of give a perspective to, really, you know, this whole story is about getting in, is helping Australians who've never talked to or known or spend any time with Aboriginal Torres Strait Islander people, to get them to see things from their perspective a little bit better, because I think that's really what journalism should do, is put someone in someone else's shoes. So to kind of give that perspective too is really why I came to Inala.
Yeah. Well, look, I really want to thank you for visiting us in the studio, but also visiting our country and meeting with our mob in different parts of Australia and wanting to do that story justice. So I've got a couple of gifts I'm going to give to you to say thank you.
Oh, too nice. Everyone's big. I feel like I'm going to have a bunch of like art and stuff because all these people have said they're going to...
You may need another suitcase, yeah. So my first gift is a book. Oh, about, of course, the Torres Straits.
Wow, okay.
It's a production put out by the Queensland Art Gallery, State Library of Queensland, about Indigenous artworks, Torres Strait Islander artworks and history and stories. So that's a kind of a memento that you can keep and take back home and to remind you of that beautiful place.
Wow, thank you so much. This is awesome.
My next little gift is a tea towel, and I had hoped to get it framed, but unfortunately I couldn't.
I can frame it back. It's easier for me to frame it back
home. Well, that's right. So I want you to read what it says.
Cherbourg Aboriginal Settlement, to whom it may concern, permit, date. The bearer has permission to be absent from this settlement from blank to blank for the purpose of...
So you know what this is?
Yeah, this is the permission to live your life, I guess. It's, wow.
So this is from the Ration Shed Museum in Cherbourg. And, of course, you said in one of our lectures this week where Aunty Denise Proud spoke about her story as an inmate at Cherbourg.
Yeah.
And so I want you to take a permit with you.
Thank you. This is my wife and I, we're just buying a new house now, and this is going to go front. This is powerful right here.
Now, the last present I want to give you is from Anala.
Okay.
You would know about this because I'm sure Damien spoke to you about the significance of this.
Yes.
And for our listeners, it's a red, yellow, black 4077 snapback. I believe you might be going to some sort of street party in the hood tomorrow, so you may have
Thank
to rep
you.
That hat.
Okay, this is awesome.
We better see it on Instagram and Twitter because
definitely.
There's a lot of our visitors from the US have come here, and we make sure they represent Anala wherever they go, and we're really pleased to have you come to our community.
Wow.
And
this is... I can't thank you enough. You know, I'm very happy to be here, and I can't thank you enough for this. This all means so much to me, like this stuff, and it's great because I can, and I love the symbolism of these in a way. Like these are all conversations. People say 4077. What's that? Then I can, and this thing right here. This is, you know, I remember there's an art project where someone was hanging up banners that they used to have back in the day, and someone hung one up where it says a person was lynched here today. They were hanging those up in New York, and I think this Cherbourg permit is a powerful conversation starter like that, and I think it's a reminder that, you know, we all need, whether we're in the US or in Australia or Africa, you know, anywhere that colonization has really reared its head, to, you know, think about how people were treated, you know, over the years, and how that legacy still continues. And
absolutely.
Still struggle.
We talk in our communities about knowing who you are and where you come from, and never forgetting that.
Yeah.
So these are something to take with you to remember where you come from when you came to this place.
Great.
Thank you
so much
for joining us.
No, thank you for having me. I'm so happy. Thank you.
You've been tuned to Let's Talk, highlighting the injustice from community to country, suburb to city, with a multitude of hosts, Bo Spearham, Carver Watson, the aunties Lilla Watson and Mary Graham, and Chelsea Bond. Weekday mornings from 9 till 10, it's Let's Talk, welcoming the continued sovereignty of all First Nations peoples right across the country.
Staying active doesn't mean we need to be running around constantly or working ourselves to the point of exhaustion. We can all do small things that improve our overall health and well-being. Brian Phillipson from Aboriginal Centre for Performing Arts suggests some ideas you can try.
It's just having that 20 minutes of activity each day. You know, it doesn't really matter. You don't have to go to the gym. You can go for a walk. You can, you know, go for a run, take the dog for a walk, go to the beach. And it's definitely summer, so a lot of beach action and all that kind of stuff. It'd be good to have that mentality, you know, being happy. You know, just go down to the park with the kids, anything like that. It's just having the activity there. So that's the important thing. I find that it'll make you more happier mentally and physically. You know, just being more proactive with day-to-day life.
Brian Phillipson from Aboriginal Centre for Performing Arts. As a guide, adults should aim to be active for 30 minutes every day. Kids over 5 years of age should aim for at least 60 minutes of activities every day. Doing small exercises can account for the 30 minutes of physical activity. Time flies when you're having fun, so breaking up 30 minutes into three lots of 10-minute intervals can be a great way to reach your daily physical activity goal. Becoming more physically active can help you to sleep better, improve your mental health, control your weight, feel more energetic, and reduce your risk of diseases like cancer, diabetes, and heart disease. If it's been a while since you've been active, speak to your GP. And for further information or tips, jump online to www.movemoresitless.org.au.
A message from the Staying Strong Project, funded by the Australian Government Department of Health.